get people's signatures to appear on the ballot, and I asked them, what do you think of the incumbent, the guy that I'm running against? 0 out of 50 people knew his name.
Wow.
0 out of 50.
When you were at the start of this journey, like, was there like a moment where you were like, I want to try and solve this problem?
Yeah, so I started working on Civ in 2020, but from 2016 to 2020, I was actually more focused on this peer-to-peer representative democracy model. Sometimes referred to as liquid democracy or liquid representation or delegative democracy. It has a bunch of different names. But the basic idea is it's a reimagining of what a Congress, a legislature, a city council, a representative democracy can now become in an information age in the 21st century. Because a lot of our design for how we currently do representative democracy was constrained by the tools and technology available in 1776, mm-hmm. which, mind you, was before Benjamin Franklin did his lightning, the key tied to the kite thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is way before electricity, long before the telegram or the telegraph or the phone or the internet or any of these things.
Or the Transcontinental Railroad, even.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one line that some people say is like, our technology of voting, like vote by mail, was invented in the Civil War.
Yeah.
It was literally used in the American Civil War, and we haven't really innovated since then.
Yeah, and our democracy was set up in the age of sail, right?
Correct, yeah.
Where wind was how we got across the ocean.
Yeah, and literally for sending messages, you would write it with a quill on parchment, and then to get it to another city, you would give it to a person on a horse, and they would ride just to go from New York City to Philadelphia, which was the capital at the time. That's a 1 week horseback ride.
Wow.
Just from New York to Philadelphia. Whereas now I can hop on a video call with someone on the other side of the world, talking real time, back and forth. Just a different world.
It is kind of crazy when you think about it. You know, my wife lives in Denver because she's in grad school right now. And we get to see each other in real time. And I'm like, you know, this is kind of cool because there is just a thing up in space that is bouncing this signal back and forth between us, making this possible. It's something that in the 1700s, I don't think you could have imagined, right?
Well, people did imagine, and it was in religious texts. I mean, this is literally the power of angels. Angels had the power to talk to other people on the other side of the world.
And now we complain about it. Yeah,
correct. Yeah. And again, it's like, it's fun to joke about this stuff, but in reality, like, let's also keep in mind that government spending is 40% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard this line the other day about catastrophic risks. The person was saying there are a number of identified, possibly catastrophic risks between, let's just say, now and 2050, so the next 25 years. And they named a few. They were talking about like pandemic risks and biological risks. They're talking about like climate change of various sorts. They're talking about like resource depletion and lack of access to research, nuclear war and that sort of thing. Now there's all this new AI, super intelligence risk. And so that's just five right there. And we could get into the details of how serious each one of those are. And that's super interesting to talk about. But the point is that there's a credible reason to be concerned that any one of these things has the potential to end billions of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
If we could just improve our ability to address these issues and like understand what are the current problems and what are the best solutions and how are we going to collectively respond to some of these problems, let's just hypothesize that we could make it we could be 5% more capable at respond because we've upgraded our telegram to an actual live video call. If you just run the numbers on that, we're talking about billions of potential lives. Like the expected value, 5%, ends up being like hundreds of millions of people's lives on the line here. And so there's some really, really large opportunities to make things better and concerns if we continue things as they're going right now,
yeah.
Which are not great.
And to your point, you know, we're talking about the right now we have democracy. We elect someone every X amount of years. And that's the input we get to give. Like, sure, there's other ways to make your voice heard. You can protest, you can write articles, you can, you know, whatever. You can like a somebody's post on TikTok. Right?
What's it called? Clicktivism?
Yeah, you can do some clicktivism. Exactly. Yeah. But I think a lot of people are frustrated because there's these positions that seem really popular that, you know, maybe the vast majority of the country supports, but we cannot get them passed into law.
Totally.
And it really often feels like there's all these things that we want to happen, but our current government apparatus is incapable of delivering them. And it's not for lack of the government having enough power to do it. It's for lack of, you know, our elected officials really reflecting what we want.
Totally.
So you were talking about, like liquid democracy, all this stuff. Can you kind of explain what is liquid democracy? What were those other names you had for it? Yeah.
Well, before I get into that, I do want to pause for just a second. So completely agree what you're saying about there are certain issues where it seems like there's a large amount of public support, and yet that doesn't translate into policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sometimes like to cheekily say that, well, we don't live in a representative democracy, we live in a misrepresentative democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And the so-called representative officials are not actually representing what the people want. And so there's a number of really clear examples of that. But one, the way that I personally contextualize that is that it's an issue of, I mean, frankly, it's an issue of corruption. And so it's like there are certain special interests that are benefiting from the status quo to the tune of billions of dollars. And so it's like concentrated benefits that they're getting from things being, you know, this particular way. And then everyone else is suffering. And there are a number of issues where you can identify that the people benefiting is like 2% of the population. And the people paying for it is like 98% of the population. And so that's clearly not representative of the population at large.
Yeah. And there's real suffering happening because of that. Yes.
Yeah. Like the simple way that I think about it is it's just like we've concentrated a huge amount of power in a small amount of hands.
Yeah.
And so like let's just say at the federal level, for example, because again, we're focusing on that just as one example. There are 435 members of Congress and 100 senators. So we're talking 500 people total that are writing all of the laws and all the policy and planning the budget for a nation of 300 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a million to one concentration. And just like I used to like doing this exercise, just asking people like, hey, so what do you think of your congressperson? What do you think of your state senator? What do you think of your city council member? I was just in a random coffee shop and I just asked people around, hey, what I asked them is, do you know your city council member's name?
Mm-hmm.
And in a random coffee shop I was at, it was like 2 out of 10.
Right.
Literally even just knew their name. Or I ran for office myself in 2018 at the state level, advocating for these ideas and making this possible. It's a really interesting story, but the basic idea was that I made this pledge that if I got elected, every single vote that I cast would be determined using this new representative model called liquid democracy. And I know I still haven't answered your question on what that means, but the point is just I'm trying to set up the fact that it's a really interesting way to bring this new model to make it possible without requiring any sort of constitutional change. People just run for office and make this pledge. And so as part of that, I had to get people's signatures to appear on the ballot. And I asked them, what do you think of the incumbent? The guy that I'm running against, who had been reelected 4 times. He had been in office for 8 years. It was 2-year terms. And he was the chair of the budget committee. And this is California. So the California state budget that particular year was $190 billion a year annual operating budget. $190 billion. And this is the chair of the committee. He doesn't have unilateral power, but he has a lot of influence over it. And I just asked random neighbors just walking around the street, I need 50 signatures. What do you think of the incumbent? 0 out of 50 people knew his name.
Wow.
0 out of 50. It's not that they had an opinion on him. They literally didn't even know his name. And he'd been reelected again and again. And so to me, it's like, yeah, again, don't hate the player, hate the game. The thing to do to get elected is fundraise. And it's really hard. Our brains, you know, there's this whole thing of like Dunbar's number. Like our brains evolved in these tribes of like 100 people, maybe up to 300 people, but like a relatively small range. And our brains are not optimized to know people on a million person scale. And so the reality is, in order to get elected, you have to just put your face on a bunch of billboards all over the place and put flyers in everyone's mailbox and door, and that costs money. And that's that. It turns out that does move the needle in a lot of ways. It's not the exclusive thing. I mean, there's a few other things going to play. I don't want to overbid it, but the reality is, like, you need a lot of money. And so the basic idea of this particular liquid democracy system is, one of the theories is that it makes it much more expensive to corrupt our representatives. It makes it, the way that I like to think about it is, what is the cost of corrupting the system? And it's built on network theory. So it's actually, it's inspired in a lot of ways by the internet itself, which the internet was designed in the 60s and maybe a little bit earlier as like ARPANET. And the original design was, let the military have a communication network that can survive nuclear exchanges. Mm-hmm. So the generals are over here. Some of them are in Washington. Some of them are in Colorado under the mountains. Some of them are on the Pacific coast. So they need to be able to send messages around and coordinate the army. And the idea was, okay, if a missile strikes this particular node, the entire network should not go down. We should reroute. Okay, this node is now offline or has been lost. And so we want to reroute around that. And so it actually has worked extremely well. The internet is really good. If a particular node goes online, there's this whole like IP packet switching, really cool stuff for people that are into network topology, which obviously is a niche interest. But the point is, we can actually apply the same sort of methodology to representation and to trust and like who's actually representing us. Right now, what we do is we centralize power in this pyramid. And so there's a tiny number of people that have a huge amount of power at the top, but then they become targets for corruption and for special interests and for these bribery attacks and blackmail and coercion attacks. And so if they get compromised, the rest of us are screwed. Mm-hmm. And so the point is, if you use this network-based peer-to-peer model, when there is corruption, we can reroute around the corruption and we can have a much more resilient model of representation, even in the face of such challenges. And so the very basic mechanism is that right now we pick our representative leaders through elections and we say, okay, five people put their name in the ring as the candidates for office and everyone can vote for one of the options. And we're going to have a single winner and they're going to go off to the Capitol and represent our entire geography. So they're going to be the representative for California or Denver or Miami or New York or, you know, some geography. And so you have to draw some boundaries, now you have to draw some lines, and then it's just all these problems about gerrymandering of can you draw lines fairly, which is fascinatingly. Yeah.
Or even we already have states and, you know, Wyoming has two senators, California has two senators.
Yeah, there's a North and a South Dakota.
Yeah.
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 And totally. And so, but that's the bet. I would say that is the best that we could do, or one of the best things that we could do 250 years ago in our pre-electricity age, when again, it was like horse, you know, we needed horses to get around. Nowadays though, what you could do is, just as one example, I'm not saying this is the best idea, but every last person could vote on every last bill. We could have a digital thing where you can see every single bill that your city council is voting on, or your state legislature, or the federal, and you could vote directly on bills. Now, that is now possible in a way that it wasn't possible before. There are some problems with that, though. The simplest one is there are a lot of bills.
There are.
And it's thousands a year.
And we have direct democracy in some ways in California.
Totally. Like, ballot propositions. Here.
Yeah.
Totally. And there's mixed reviews. Some people like it. Some people hate it. There's some good arguments to be had that it has some good parts and some bad parts. Mm-hmm. And the simple way that I think about it, there was this line that Abraham Lincoln used in the Gettysburg Address, which is this amazing speech. If you haven't heard it, I highly recommend it. It's like 2 minutes long, super short. But he has this line about, like, we sanctify this battlefield for the people that fought to complete the unfinished work of democracy, mm-hmm. was this line that he used. And it gives me chills just thinking about it now. But just this line that it's unfinished. And the way that I personally contextualize it is, like, the word democracy, it's a Greek word. It's rule by the people, by the demos. And the term itself goes back to ancient Athens, like 500 BC, like Solon and, Thucydides wasn't a historian. But anyway, these ancient figures. And the idea was everywhere around them had kings, like the Persian Empire had kings. But the Spartans had kings, but yeah. The Athenians did not. Yeah. The Athenians had this, they didn't use the word republic because that's Latin, but this public thing that everyone owned collectively, which res publica. Interestingly, people think republic means representative, but it doesn't. That's a misunderstanding. It means public thing. But the point is that to me, that's like ancient Athenian democracy. The way that the Athenians did it was all the citizens, which were only land-holding males, so it was not the whole population. They had slaves. Women were not allowed to vote. Yeah. But the land-holding males, which I think was at different points, it was like 10,000 people or so, they would all gather on the top of this hill or in the agora, and they would have these debates and say, should we do this or that? And they would literally gather in person. And so to me, direct democracy makes sense when people can meet face-to-face on like a city level. Potentially, but like a small, I mean, this is like thousands of years ago city, not a modern city. And so I genuinely think it has scaling issues. And so I think of that as democracy 1.0. Then we have our representative democracies, or what I term electoral representative democracy. And so this is like 1776 democracy. And this is like, okay, we're going to spread out all over the continent. We still want our, Maine still wants to be represented, or North Dakota, or Virginia wants to be represented, or what have you. And so we're going to send one representative over, but there's like a mostly agrarian economy. And so I think of that as democracy 2.0. And so now we live in the 21st century. Now we can talk to people on the other side of the world over the internet. We can send billions of bytes back and forth. And so I think of this as democracy 3.0. So it's just improving the overall, it's just part of the natural swing of things. And so the basic idea is that each and every citizen starts with a voting power of one, and you can vote directly on any bill you want. You can say, I'm in favor, I think this is a good proposal, or I think this is a bad proposal. But more interestingly, you can also pick representatives. And what this means is that if you don't vote on a bill, your representative can vote on your behalf as your proxy, voting, which is very common in shareholder voting and shareholder sorts of situations, is they're going to vote on my behalf. And so now you introduce this notion of voting power. And so maybe I have 20 friends that think highly of me. And so they all say, look, David, you study this stuff much more than we do. Each of us individually are gonna let you be my backup representative. Representation becomes a backup. If you want to look into the issues, you can always represent yourself directly on any issue. And then you can start to do other really interesting things. Like you can say, okay, different domain-specific representation. So you can say, when it's a foreign policy issue, this is who I trust. Mm. When it's a climate issue, this is who I trust. When it's a tax policy issue, or it's a AI policy issue, or it's a healthcare policy issue. And so there are different people that I think are good at different, you know, the different areas of expertise. So this is one model for representation. There are a bunch of other really good ideas too. This is not in any way the only alternative model for representative democracy. There's really interesting things around citizens' assemblies and these ideas inspired by juries. There's really interesting ideas around market mechanisms, like using information markets and prediction markets to try to get good signal on which policies will actually work or not. Now, over the last few years, there's been huge amounts of interest in having your own AI representative. What's really interesting about this peer-to-peer model is that it actually is inclusive of all these other models. Someone could spin up a citizen jury thing, and you could say, I trust that. I want that to represent me. Or someone could spin up some sort of AI. You could have a marketplace of different AIs competing to represent you as best as they can. And the point is, you can always fire your representative.
And just change to something else or represent yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's personalized representation. That's part of the whole idea. And so these are just some ideas. There's a whole bunch of really good ideas, but the point is all of these become vastly easier once things become digital. And so that's where Civ slots in again. Civ is like, again, it's the web browser. It's getting your fundamental basic rights and recognition that you are a citizen in this body in a digital setting in a safe way, so that then we can start expanding to all sorts of really powerful new models.
I love all the visions of what democracy can be. I think that people get very much stuck in, even when we talk about change, thinking about how do we move an inch? You know, how do we just make it so that we work only slightly better, you know, but
which is important.
It's important. Like, you know, I think I started there today, which is like, what if we could just get more people to turn out to vote? It would be huge, actually, just totally. to increase. If we doubled the number of people who voted, I think that it wouldn't completely solve every problem we're having, but it would make a big impact on what actually happens in this country.
Well, and there's certain settings where I would argue it's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. So in particular, the primaries, the party primaries, have extremely low turnout.
Yeah.
So there was one last year. This was the, I want to say it was also an Iowa primary. They had a blizzard. And so they ended up having less than 1% turnout in that particular presidential primary.
I also wonder if we're in a situation like we had with Kamala Harris, you know, where Joe Biden backed out of the election last minute and Kamala Harris became the candidate.
Correct.
Nobody voted for Kamala Harris, right?
Well, Joe Biden endorsed her, and that was it.
Joe Biden endorsed her. She was the candidate.
No primary.
Right? No primary. And I wonder if having digital voting would have been something that would at least have let the Democratic Party say, like, hey, you have a choice here. Because I understand in a way it was a tough situation. Things had to happen fast. But if you could just say, like, hey, we're all
do this tonight.
Yeah, we're all like, get out your
hundreds
phones.
Of millions
we're,
of people.
We're doing it, you know?
Correct.
And it would at least give some legitimacy to your choice, and it would give people a real option. So
correct.
If you really did not want Kamala Harris to represent you, you could say, like, no, I want this other person who's challenging.
So this is not theoretical.
Yeah.
We literally did this.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so I was pretty frustrated all of early 2024 with the lead up of Joe Biden versus Donald Trump rematch. I personally think both of them have their pros and cons, and I don't even want to get into all the details there. But the point is, we have a country of 300 million people. Without a doubt, there are better options than these two people.
That was my feeling going into the election.
Right. And so there's different ways of vote. There's different types of votes as well. So there's this whole thing where like ranked choice voting, and there's what's called score voting. So like in the Olympics, you know, the figure skater does their move, or the fancy gymnast do their move, and then the judges hold up a number of like 1 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's score voting. And even like when you're voting on podcasts, or you're giving your Uber driver like a star review, you're actually doing score voting, you know, 1 through 5. And so there's some really interesting research in the academic field called social choice theory, that it turns out that these better voting methods leave vastly more people happy. And so I was really excited to create this platform called scorepresident.com, where you could just say, okay, of these candidates, where would you like? Anyway, maybe I shouldn't drag too much on that, because that we did not end up doing. But then what we did do is Joe Biden had this disastrous debate where everyone was like, oh my God, it turns out he's not going to be capable to run. We need to get him out immediately. This was in late June. And so I was introduced to some people that were really interested in, can we do an online vote to pick the alternative? And the really interesting thing was there was huge amounts of sentiment at the time that, okay, Joe Biden needs to go. It doesn't seem like he's going to be able to make it to Election Day, and certainly not for 4 years,
mm-hmm.
but it's unclear who the alternative should be. And so there's sort of like analysis paralysis, or like the paradox of choice, where if you have too many options, it can really freeze people up. And so it turns out this is what these alternative voting methods are optimized for. This is exactly what they're best for. And so we set up this thing. It was called the New American Primary. And you can still see it. I think it's newamericanprimary.com or .org. And so we had the top 11 serious contenders that people were talking about. Kamala Harris was one of them. And there are a bunch of other people, some senators and governors and popular choices. And so anyone could just rank them in the order they wanted. And it was a very nice interface. My first choice, my second choice. And it animated in this cool way where mm-hmm. you made your personal choices. And then it used this much better. There's like some really interesting nuance on different ranked choice voting algorithms. And so it used this really cool thing called ranked robin under the hood, where all the options got head-to-head matchups. And it also had really interesting identity verification. It was doing some like passport verification stuff. And so about 400 people ended up using it. We built it as this first like proof of concept. The idea was we were going to get it into the DNC and let all the DNC delegates use it so that they would be unblocked. But then By the time we had, it took us about 2 weeks to set it up. By the time we had it all set up, the next morning, Joe Biden announced he's stepping aside and Kamala Harris, he's endorsing Kamala Harris. And so that ended up happening. And then, of course, Kamala Harris lost. And I think there's an extremely convincing case to be made that forgetting to run a primary was one among many decisive factors in her not winning. And so 100% just to your point, unexpected things happen. It's nice to have flexibility. And so, yeah.
Okay. So maybe we should just dive into kind of what's the process that happens when you vote online, when you vote digitally, right? Mm-hmm. And what are the possible security issues that can happen there?
Totally.
Let's just start there.
So at a high level, there's this, so cybersecurity, broad field, a lot of different ways that it can be attacked. Like one of the famous things is there was this group like Anonymous that would like hack these websites. And what that literally meant is they'd like load the website and press refresh a bunch of times. Like this is like a DDoS attack. Uh-huh. And if you get tens of thousands of people all doing that, press, or they like script it so it happens more automatically, that will overload the service and take it down. Mm-hmm. And so that's falls in this category of an availability attack. You've made the service unavailable. And so at a high, very high level, there's this thing called the CIA triad, which is a funny name. It's not the Central Intelligence Agency, but it stands for confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And I personally find this an extremely helpful way to break down different possible types of attacks. So confidentiality attacks is like somebody learned some private information they weren't supposed to learn, like you, any sort of privacy attack, mm-hmm. or they like doxed you. So integrity would be like tampering with votes, like announcing fake votes that weren't there, maybe like sneaking in fake voters that weren't supposed to be in the voter roll in the first place, something that attacks the integrity of the election. And then availability is just like voter suppression effectively in an election context.
Can you actually vote?
Yeah, making it difficult for people to vote. And so all of these are in play. Getting a little bit more, those are sort of the broad categories. So getting more concrete in a voting setting, I can kind of just list off a bunch of very real concerns that people that have studied the issues have raised. So one is about, your vote just getting lost or tampered with or changed, which again could happen on the server getting penetrated and changing everyone's votes at once. The much harder and kind of gnarly version of this is on voters' own devices. Their own device is compromised by malware and their own device. You click the button, your device shows you that you voted for George Washington, but then it encrypts a vote for Benedict Arnold and that's what it sends in. And the server didn't do anything wrong. The server is totally honest, but your own device is cheating mm-hmm. against you. So that's like an on-device malware attack. Privacy attacks, like people learn how you vote in particular ways, or that kind of enables these like bribery attacks, like large scale, people are paying you to vote a particular way. And then again, all these different types of availability attacks, which could be like high scale, like DDoS the server and cause the whole server to go down, which some people have framed this as like, okay, you could imagine that people that are voting digitally will have a slight, you'll have a bias towards particular candidates, and people that are voting by mail or voting in person will have a different bias. And so if you can DDoS the digital services, especially at the very last minute, you could have targeted suppression like we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. And so that could actually swing the vote in particular ways and that are not great. That's a serious thing. There's also, instead of DDoS is like large scale availability attacks, you could also do more subtle suppression where you see, this person is statistically most likely to vote for this candidate. And so we'll just create a lot of errors when they try to submit their vote and like slow things down. So it's more targeted suppression. So it's another very serious concern. So these are kind of the high level list of attacks that a lot of people are concerned about with votes. Just like all the votes go, everyone casts their vote and then someone takes over the server and just deletes them all the votes go missing. That would be a pretty serious, it would just disrupt completing the election.
And you mentioned that a lot of experts have said, like, we have big concerns about, elections being able to be carried out digitally because of these attacks, right?
Yep.
Is CIV addressing these concerns? And what are those biggest ones?
Yeah, so the CIV protocol has been designed to meet just about all of the ones I named. Again, there's always a difference between preventing attacks versus detecting attacks. If you can prevent attacks, that's ideal. That's always the best. But sometimes you can't prevent attacks, but you can still detect them, which is it's still very good because the vast majority of time the attacks are not taking place. And sometimes detection itself is a deterrent. Like when you know that there's a camera looking at you, you're less likely to commit a crime because, you know, someone will catch you. And so, yeah, so Civ can prove, it can give you verifiable results. So that one's quite important. So all the, we focused very hard on all the integrity things. That's what we wanted to start with because that's extremely important. And so every last voter can be sure that their vote as they intended to cast it actually got counted correctly, actually made in the final tally, that the server's not cheating, that their own phone didn't cheat, that the network's not dropping their votes in any place along the way. And so that's extremely important. We haven't focused as much on the availability attacks, like the DDoS attacks, and we definitely could improve there. Although with that said, the interesting thing about availability attacks is you know that it's happened. You know, yes, that your server, hey, GitHub just went offline.
I'm also wondering if the fact that, you know, like if you have an election and you're doing only in-person voting, you're kind of limited by the resources you have of,
correct,
you know, you're, yep, open for as many hours as people, correct, can staff the polls. But, correct, if you're voting by mail or online, you can have the polls be open for 30 days.
Correct.
Right. Or whatever period you, correct, want. Yep. So it's, is it hard to mount a DDoS attack over that extended period of time?
Yes, correct. DDoS attacks are exactly, they cost, it's like, yeah, it's the amount of traffic you're trying to send at the thing times the amount length of time that you're sustaining it. Mm-hmm. So like there have been some really high scale ones that lasted for 7 seconds, and that's enough to, let's say, overload the servers and cause them to shut down, but then they get back up again. Like, and so this, we haven't focused as much on that. We definitely could improve it in a whole bunch of ways, but it hasn't been a problem yet. We've been, hundreds of thousands of votes have been cast. There's no evidence that any vote has ever been suppressed from this sort of attack. And just like, there's trillions of dollars of the economy that runs on the internet all the time. It's hard to perfectly solve this problem, but there are lots and lots of good enough solutions to that particular problem, these availability attacks. There's also the privacy side of things. So that was sort of the second thing that we focused. First, we focused on integrity really hardcore. Then we focused a lot on privacy. And so we've spent a lot of work on making it, providing really strong guarantees, really strong processes so that no one else can learn how you vote. And unfortunately, it does involve some fancy cryptography. And so the average person is not going to investigate. Like the average person doesn't know how end-to-end encryption works when they use iMessage or Signal, mm-hmm, or what have you. But it's there and experts can review it. And we want to make it easier and more verifiable in all sorts of ways. And then the other thing that took a while, that it took us a long time to really dig into focusing on this, was about fears of bribery attacks. So this was actually arguably holding us back for a long time. For a long time, I was kind of dismissive of this sort of thing. This has been a long-standing, I want to almost use the word obsession, in computer science communities among computer scientists. A friend of mine said that when he was taking a cryptography course at MIT as an undergraduate, he said literally the first day that they talked about cryptography and voting, they said it is a requirement that no one can learn how you vote, or else you can have these bribery attacks. Mm-hmm. And I just bring that up to say that it's actually not something that non-computer scientist people basically ever think about. Like the average person, it's just not really coming up.
And what is the bribery attack exactly?
So the basic idea is, so there's this fundamental tension that if you can verify how you vote, then in theory you can prove how you vote to a third party. And so that this opens the door to what's believed to be large-scale bribery attacks, where pick your boogeyman, whether it's Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin or Darth Vader, you know, whoever your personal boogeyman is, they're going to offer you $1,000 to vote for their puppet candidate. And so the fear is that this disrupts the free and fairness of the election, that no one is supposed to learn how you vote. And when you have these cryptographic voting systems that include large-scale proof, then you can start digitizing these proof systems and it can happen remotely. And so there's the way the problem is framed, which I take issue with, I don't think this is correct. The way it's framed is that paper voting is immune to this, digital voting is vulnerable to this particular attack. And therefore, we can't do digital voting because it will open the door to these attacks. Now, that's obviously untrue for a whole bunch of reasons. The simplest one, of if you have a vote by mail ballot, I can take my vote by mail ballot, sign the envelope with my actual signature, leave the ballot itself blank, and hand it to you, and you hand me $20. There's no record of it. I just sold you my vote. Right. I mean, that just right now.
Yes.
And I could bring it into my office. You know, the fear is like about employers. You could bring it to the office. You're going to be fired if you don't give us your vote. So this is all currently possible. It is incorrect to assume that this is not possible. There's fear in like religious communities or like social communities or like spousal issues that like husbands and wives will like threaten to coerce each other about voting a particular way. So again, all this is currently possible. And so even remotely, one of the ways that this was framed is like, okay, but that's all in person. What about remote? Now when it's digital, you can prove to the remote person. So the way it was framed is like, sure, someone could hand you the $20, but they're within the reach of law enforcement. They live in our country, you know, they're physically there. Mm-hmm. Versus now, once you make it digital, you could sell your vote to a smart contract, or you could sell your vote to someone on the other side of the world, far outside of the reach of law enforcement. Again, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I can take my vote by mail ballot, turn on my camera on my phone, and video record myself.
That's what I was going to say. Can't I just prove how I voted by sending
hop on a
picture?
Video call? Yeah. And hop on a video call with someone. I can drop it in the Dropbox in front of them. And so this is there's a lot of misinformation about how secure our status quo is against this type of attack. So for a long time, we were very dismissive of it, but some computer scientists were really angry at us. There's some really viral videos. If you search this issue, you can look up. There's this pretty famous YouTuber called Tom Scott, where he talks about this. He says why we can't vote digitally. It has like 10 million views. Very popular video. And I'm not saying that he's wrong. The issues he raises are legitimate, especially at the time. These are kind of older videos. And so he's focusing on, you can like, someone can hold a gun to your head and ask you to prove how you vote. But that actually happens in person. That's already possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Anyway, so we were pretty dismissive of this, but a lot of people were really angry at us for being rather dismissive about it. And so we finally got it through our thick skulls to listen to them and take it seriously. And so we spent the last year, we developed this really powerful new tool, this new technology, where any voter, everyone casts CIV votes like they naturally do. But if any vote, our basic view is that the average voter is not facing these sorts of threats or risks of like coercion attacks or bribery attacks.
It's like not unheard of, but
it's not unheard of.
It's probably not typical.
In the U.S., it's certainly, there's very little evidence that it's typical. There's some cases made that it's very widespread in Brazil or in India or in other jurisdictions. And in cryptocurrency spaces, it's actually extremely common because it's like we're voting on whether to unlock billions of dollars of funds. And so if you can just bribe people, then it's like, and so we worked with a bunch of the cryptocurrency people. They've been working on this problem for a while, and they had come up with this design called MACI, M-A-C-I, which stands for Minimal Anti-Collusion Infrastructure. And the basic idea is it uses some, again, fancy cryptography where you can construct a fake proof. And so it's a weapon that we can give to voters to use against would-be bribers or coercers. And so it empowers voters with these new tools to trick the bribers or the coercers. And so the basic idea is 99% of people don't face these threats, but some people might face these threats. If someone says, vote the way I want you to and I'll pay you $1,000, or vote the way I want you to or you're fired, you can say, sure thing, no problem. Cast the vote the way that they want, cast your original vote the way you want to. And basically this allows you to like self-destruct your CIV vote in this using these zero knowledge proofs verifiable way and create basically a fake proof. And so then you're giving them a fake proof, and then you can cast a secret override. It's called a verifiable private override in person using paper, still protect against malware because that's part of our design criteria. And so it's actually, we've jujitsu'd this problem where in the past we have this cool page where we look at all the different qualities that you want out of a voting system. And we always acknowledge that this notion of coercion resistance, CIV was weaker to than voting in person or voting by mail, but they were not immune from it either. But we had this metric. Now with this new capability, we've actually leapfrogged vote by mail. And now it's actually better than you can achieve with vote by mail.
It's like as if you were able to show up to the polling place and take a fake video of yourself voting and dropping it in, right? And send it to the person.
Exactly.
But the digital version of that.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah, we frame it as it's the cryptographic an analog of constructing a deep fake video.
That's kind of cool.
And it's super. And what's interesting, the math is rather esoteric. I mean, it's, some people refer to these things as moon math. These zero knowledge proofs. It's quite interesting. It's crazy polynomials and stuff. But the good news is in order to use it, you don't have to understand any of that stuff. It's actually, we've optimized making it really easy to use. And so what you would do is you'd go in person and you'd say, I want to cast one of these secret overrides. I'm under risk of this coercion or bribery threat. And so you just click a button and it opens a QR code that takes some private info from your vote. And so you're constructing a proof that you were the original voter, mm-hmm. and you're authorizing your vote to be self-destructed and then casting your replacement vote. And so it takes like less than 2 minutes, super easy. Someone can hold your hand while you're doing it. And it's awesome. And we've gotten to share it. What the really exciting thing from my point of view is we've gotten to share it with these critics who were really worried. And they're like, oh, that's actually really interesting. Yes, oh, I really like that.
It's a cool solution.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I'm going to revise my analogy. It's like you take the video of your real ballot. You have a second secret ballot that you're going to fill out later. And you've got like that Mission Impossible, like this ballot will self-destruct in 5 seconds thing happening, right? I just watched all of them with my neighbor. So I've seen every Mission Impossible now.
Totally.
So,
yeah. And the other thing I always loved about Mission Impossible is they had these incredible masks. They're so convincing. Yeah. And so this is I would say it's kind of like that as well, where you're like deep faking your own vote.
Wow, Mission Impossible. It's the gold mine of analogies today.
Yeah. I mean, it's a crazy thing. Voting is a crazy thing because for the average person, they barely think about the like process and logistics. It's like get in, get out, fast thing. You do it once or twice, you know, every other year. But under the hood, there's like it is, we're literally trying to make it intelligence agency proof. I mean, it's literally dealing with all this spy stuff. And the cryptography was originally invented for securing nuclear weapons. We're using this like multi-party key stuff, which was used for securing nuclear, like arming and decentralizing the key. So the math and the technology is amazing. So there's kind of three elements that make this whole problem hard. There's the very real hard technology side of things. And we've done amazing, I would argue, really good work there. Then there's the political side of things that we were kind of touching on earlier. And we're making good progress, but we still have a long way to go. I'd say we're like 1% of where we need to be. Mm-hmm. And then there's one other side as well, which is like just like the economic side of things and like the sustainability side of things. There are some real genuine issues of like with a lot of technology. Like if you take your phone, your iPhone has billions of dollars of R&D invested in it, or your Android phone, billions of dollars of R&D invested in all the sensors and the screen and the operating system and all the various parts. But then you can buy it at the store for like $500.
Yeah.
Or like, and so there's this incredible economy of scale with technology. And so voting faces a somewhat similar situation where if you're like, we have been investing years and years and years of some of the top talent. We have amazing people that help us work on this stuff, like really brilliant people from all sorts of different disciplines. And so now we've packaged it all into this easy to use thing. And it's genuinely, it's taken a long time. And so that is also really hard, being able to just like solve all these problems and make it practical and get it into people's hands. And like a lot of election officials, they're not necessarily technologists. They're like, they're really good at following the rules and they're really good at following up with people and they're really rigorous, but they're not necessarily like engineers or inventors. And oftentimes they won't necessarily be in their role for that long either. There's actually a surprisingly high amount of turnover. And so just being able to like invest the time that it takes with the level of expertise required is a surprisingly challenging thing. And then judging like legitimate solutions versus bad solutions, because there are a number of people out there pushing other systems designs that are that still have a lot of vulnerabilities, and so that's another thing that makes it tricky. So just circling all these solving all these problems, is it's an ongoing process.
It is a pretty crazy complex problem. I mean, You know, we were talking about just taking voting for granted earlier, right, and thinking, and even with our current system, there's a lot of worries about election integrity all the time. I mean, whether it's good faith or bad faith actions, it's something that elected officials take action on totally all the time. So I'm guessing there's a lot of challenge in taking this incredibly complex technical thing and saying, okay, hey, voters, this is secure. You should trust this.
Well, so our philosophy is don't trust it, actually.
I like that. Okay, yeah. Why is that?
Well, there's this, it's a bit of a buzzword, but there's this idea in the security world of what's called zero trust, which is like, you shouldn't need to trust someone else's computer or someone else's software. It's like, we can actually prove to you that your vote made it in there correctly without being changed. And so, yeah, there's a really interesting dynamic where a lot of people are really scared to try Civ and like use it for the first time. But then after people use it, they overwhelmingly love it. Like 99.9% of voters are like, yeah, that was great. It was so simple. It's like, it's one of those things. It's like infrastructure. It's like plumbing. Like, it's amazing to have hot water. It's amazing to have flushable toilets. And you don't think about it until it breaks.
Yeah.
But there's like a genuinely lot of thought that goes into this sort of thing. And so it's one of these like hidden infrastructures of society sort of things. But one thing just about the point of like mistrust around elections specifically, we've gotten the chance now to run some elections with people that historically might be labeled as election deniers. It's kind of a weird term because they're not denying that. They're, I guess they're denying the legitimacy of elections. Yeah. And so they're in this community of people. It's like 700, this particular group that I'm thinking of, there were like 700 voters, and maybe like a cohort of like 100 of them are just don't, you know, they don't trust anyone. They think all the results are cheating. Their candidate's losing and they're unhappy about that. And so part of the whole philosophy of Civ is that you don't have to do any work ahead of time. After the results come out, when your preferred candidate lost, then you can follow we give you, all you have to do is follow these steps and you can go to different levels of depth to actually confirm the results. And so one of the things that was really remarkable was in this one election that we ran where there were these people that were like agitating, there's a term like fear, uncertainty, and doubt, FUD, where they're like spreading a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about election results. In this particular election, that the group had been voting for many years, and now they switched to using Civ. And this amazing thing happened, which is that historically with elections, like in, let's just say the 2020 election is one example, you have a group of people that look into it and see a lot of concerning things. And you have a group of people that try to look into it, and they seem to be reassured by what they see. And typically these are generally about like 10% at max. And then you have this massive group of people, like 80% of people that don't have the time to study it. Mm-hmm. They're not really looking into it. They don't really know what's going on. And they're like, well, those people seem more trustworthy than those people or vice versa. And so the reality is in the current status quo, for the vast majority of people, you are kind of taking things on faith. The security model is like, we don't have evidence of problems. And so it's like, there's a lack of issues raised. Whereas what Civ creates is actually positive proof of correct results. So it's actually an entirely stronger paradigm.
So you can kind of track your vote. You can correct. Say, there it goes. And it's, correct. Yeah, it's been counted.
Correct.
And the person that I voted for
correct.
Is the one who is, yeah, correct. Who that
you
vote
know
is going
that your
for.
Vote made
yeah.
in there. Yeah. And I forgot to mention this, but there's another type of attack possible there, which is that voters can falsely claim that their vote got lost.
Mm-hmm.
Which people worry about is like, oh, they're upset about the results. Oh. They're going to allege, oh, my vote went missing.
But with Civ, you can actually say, oh, we can see your vote was received. Right?
Well, we don't know what your vote is. Right?
We don't know what your vote was, but we can say.
We can say there was a vote from this person, from Alice.
And it was successfully unpackaged and added into the results.
But it's possible, like you're casting your vote from your phone. It's possible that your own phone cheated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's outside of our control. We don't know whether your phone right. is backdoored yeah. or not. And so there's a legitimate concern there of if you're depending on voters, if voters have the ability to call foul, some cynical voters will maliciously call foul when their vote did not actually get tampered with, just to spread more fear about the election itself. And so we've developed this additional protocol where all the voters that call foul can all say, okay, you know, my vote, I'm saying that my vote got tampered with. I'm saying my vote. And so let's say that's 100 people. And then we can just take the votes representing those 100 people, remix those ones up themselves, unlock them, tally them up. And we can see, okay, if we had, they are now abdicating those votes. They're saying my vote got lost. And so we could call those the claimed compromise votes. And so now we look at what is the total if we were to remove the claimed compromise from the final total. Does that mean, does that make it the current winner did better? Or sorry, the current winner did worse, like it was the wrong winner got declared? Or the other possibility is they were actually lying to you when they said that their vote got tampered with, and now they genuinely cast a vote for a losing candidate. Now we're subtracting out their losing vote, and now their preferred candidate is losing by even more. Mm-hmm. And so the point is, the rabbit hole goes deep, but we're protecting even against this particular type of bad faith, malice attack. But I do want to just go back a tiny bit. So with these election deniers, what happens, you have the 10% of people that spread the FUD, the 10% of people say, oh, it was the safest election ever in history. How can anyone that would claim that there's a problem is a terrible person, an irresponsible mm-hmm. actor. And if you ask questions, you're a bad person. And then you have the 80% of people that are kind of in the middle. What was amazing with this election that we ran is they all tried to do their FUD thing again. But now the people in the middle were like, wait a second. We all looked at the verification problem. We participate in this too. We can see that the results are right. So shut up. Before you have this large group of people that can't tell the difference, and so they're like a fertile ground for these FUD campaigns, and now all of a sudden these FUD campaigns just go nowhere near as far.
Yeah. And so you still have the FUDders, but yeah. it's hard for them to like have a leg to stand on. Correct. Right. Yeah.
And the reality is if you have evidence of a problem, I want to know it more than anyone. Right, yeah. I don't want fake results either.
Yeah.
And so it's just the paradigm is moving towards evidence-based results rather than, well, we don't have anything and we got to move forward. So yeah. You know, this is the best we can do.
Okay. I think we could talk about this all day.
Totally.
I love talking about elections with you. I think Civ is so exciting. I know all of us want to be able to vote at home. I think all of us want to just like live in a better democracy.
Yeah, sounds nice.
I'm really excited about like the vision that you have and the possibilities that of things that we haven't even thought about yet.
Totally.
Thank you so much for coming in, David.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. If you enjoyed what you saw today, please like, subscribe, share, leave a comment. Really helps us keep making this happen.